Und jetzt kommen wir zum Thema, das wir jetzt dieses Jahr schon häufiger behandelt haben. Und zwar, wie ist die aktuelle Situation unter anderem in Sri Lanka? Wie kann man nach sozusagen 12 Jahren, seit 2004 sozusagen, was hat sich da verändert in Sri Lanka nach dem Tsunami? Wie geht man jetzt damit um und was leisten dort jetzt unter anderem auch die Soziologen, unter anderem Siri Hettich, der dort seit den 80er Jahren im Grunde unterrichtet, und seine Schwerpunkte sind unter anderem, Social Politics, Youth, Education, Ethnicity and Politics. Und eines der letzten Bücher war Governance, Conflict and Development in Southeast Asia mit Eva Gerhards. Wir sprechen im Grunde auch über die Möglichkeiten und Chancen der Jugend in Sri Lanka und welche Veränderungen es jetzt die letzten Jahre gegeben hat. Denn Sri Lanka war auch aufgrund des Bürgerkriegs dort zwischen Tamilen und Singalesen circa 30 Jahre im Krieg. Und erst seit 2009, beziehungsweise hat sich die Situation verbessert, und seit letztem Jahr 2015 gibt es eine neue Regierung. Und da fangen wir sozusagen an und steigen das Gespräch ein. Siri Hettich unterrichtet in Colombo, in Sri Lanka, University of Colombo.
You know, as you know, we had a change of government last year, yeah. At the beginning of last year. And that was a major change after many, many years,
yeah.
Especially after the war. Sri Lanka was faced with a series of challenges. One was, of course, the whole development issue. And then the second, was, lack of reconciliation among ethnic communities after the war. And the third was increasing inequality and injustice in the country. So Sri Lanka really had to have a breakthrough, and the people were very much interested in bringing about a change in the way the country is governed. So in January 2015, we had the presidential elections, and there was a change. And that was very, very welcome by almost everyone. And people expected a major change in the way the country is governed after the presidential elections. Looking at this whole issue, I felt that unless, we academics from the universities, impress upon the government, the newly elected government, and also the public service and other institutions, and also, of course, the general public, that we need to have reasonable, rational, long-term public policies to address the pressing and persisting issues in the country. Now, I mentioned basically three things: the development issue, the second, was basically a lack of unity among people after the war, and then the third was growing inequalities. You know, rural-urban inequalities, income distribution. Let's say private consumption taking precedence over public consumption, and so on and so forth. So I talked to some people, and I brought together several hundred intellectuals, and also civil society activists and public servants. And then we invited the president to come, and we communicated to the president the need to have sound national policies to address various issues that we are faced with in the country. And he agreed. And then he even went to the extent of asking us to come up with a framework for the new government. And then, of course, we took that challenge also. So while we were working on policy frameworks for a whole range of areas, we also came up with a proposal for the government to consider with respect to the restructuring of the government itself, like in terms of the number of ministries, the naming of ministries, division of subjects, and then also running of these ministries, and so on and so forth. So we came up with a package, the whole package, and we expected the government to basically, follow, or rather, adopt, the framework that we proposed. But then, looking back after more than a year now, we realized that we have not been able to really have the breakthrough that we were looking for. And there are various reasons for this, and that we can discuss. But I think we certainly have to have a rational approach to resolving problems in the country. So far we have not been able to really do much, but we hope that in the next months and years to come, we would be able to, bring, the government and the public institutions on track, so that we might be able to deal with the problems in an effective way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In 2 weeks.
Pardon?
Now that you can deal with the problem in 2 weeks?
Yeah, first thing is, of course, the economy, right? Because the Sri Lanka's economy is not in good shape at the moment, and the economy needs to be restructured. Of course, it is easier said than done, but nevertheless, we have to do it. Now, I'll give you some examples. Now, the labor question in Sri Lanka is huge. Labor question, in the sense that people are, really not happy with the work, the wages, working conditions, and so and so forth.
Yeah.
And many people are leaving the country, looking for work elsewhere. Now, for instance, if you take a temporary migration for work in the Middle East and East Asia, it accounts for nearly a quarter of the labor force, which is a huge problem, because when you have nearly 25% of the workforce employed outside the country, it creates a lot of distortions in the local economy in terms of, because naturally when there is a labor shortage, wages go up. When the wages go up, people cannot really produce things cheaply. Say, for instance, in the rural areas, agriculture has come across huge problems, because you can't find workers. And even if you find workers, you have to pay very high wages, which means that, you know, agriculture is almost impossible in some parts of the country. You know, so the farmers have basically abandoned large tracts of land, which means an enormous resource being underutilized or maybe even unutilized in some. And then, of course, when the labor is expensive, you have to cut costs somewhere in order to maintain your farm. And they have started using, let's say, pesticides and, you know, weedicides, you know, to control weeds. In the past, you know, you employ workers, and the workers go and control weeds. But now you can't employ people because labor is so expensive, and therefore you spray weedicide to control weeds, which means that you poison the crops, you poison the soil. So the point is that the farmers have no choice, because when the labor is scarce and expensive, they naturally look for a substitute. Instead of abandoning agriculture altogether, they use, you know, these very convenient ways of controlling pests and weeds and so on. And now, as a result, we have a huge public health crisis in the country. So you can see, you know, these problems are interconnected. And then you have when the labor is expensive, you cannot really you don't get investors to come in. Because in 1977, when we liberalized the economy, our advantage was cheap labor. Now, Sri Lanka has no advantage anymore. Cheap labor advantage gone. In other words, we cannot invite investors to come to Sri Lanka and start industries because labor is expensive. I mean, say, for instance, of course, you know, it depends on what kind of industry, but the point is that if you look for labor-intensive industries, it's not possible anymore in Sri Lanka. Because, say, for instance, the garment industry has been very badly affected by higher wages and scarcity of labor. Now, that is the only industrial sector that we developed in the country after economic liberalization, like garment industry. Now, garment industry has come down, and now garment industry is confined to, you know, high-end garment industries. In other words, large factories producing cheap garment is not possible in Sri Lanka anymore. So those investors have gone to other countries. For instance, the Bangladesh has thrived, because of you know, the proliferation of garment industries there. In other words, more and more people have gone there to establish garment factories, but they don't come to Sri Lanka anymore. So we have that problem. And then, of course, when you have no cheap labor, not only industrial production is not possible, it is also not possible to have agriculture. It is also not possible to have other economic activities if it is based entirely on cheap labor. So now when the rural economy is weak, people naturally migrate to the cities. Now, as a result, we have a new urbanization happening in Sri Lanka. That is, you know, around in and around Colombo, you have a high concentration of people now. Nearly a third of the country's population today is concentrated in one province, and that is the Western province. Now, you can imagine the kind of pressures that this population, increasing population, exerts on one single province. And you have all the problems that you can think of in the Western province today. For instance, you know, huge public health problems because of overcrowding. And then the pressure on public services like transport, health, education, and so on. So the point is that we have some problems which are unprecedented, because in Sri Lanka we did not have these problems in the past. And it's because of this rural-urban migration that we have this problem. And so the point that I'm trying to make here is that we have to look at the economy and see how we could, you know, find ways to restructure this economy in order to address pressing issues. Now it is not, it is easier said than done, but nevertheless we have no choice. Now I'll give an example. Now when labor is not cheap, when labor is scarce, how do you establish industries? Because when you have to diversify the economy, you have to, today we are talking about three sectors. I mean, in any country, we talk about three sectors. We talk about agriculture, we talk about industry, we talk about services. Now, you can't have a distorted pattern of development in the sense that you can't have one sector dominating. You have to have a balance, right? Now, for instance, today in Sri Lanka, the service sector dominates the economy. That is not possible. Because at the end of the day, you need commodities. If you don't produce commodities in the country, you know, you have to import commodities. That is not healthy. Because, you know, we have to use local resources to produce agricultural and industrial goods that the people need. Whether we like it or not, we have to have in commodities. Now, when you don't produce commodities, when you produce services, you know, then that economy cannot be sustained because you know, now in a country like Sri Lanka, we have that kind of distortion in the economy today. Now how do you get over this problem? Now, for instance, if you can't have industries based on cheap labor, in countries where you don't have cheap labor, you have to go for value-added products, you know, high value-added products. And you also have to use technology, new technologies for production activities. In other words, you have to come up with a new set of products. Now, say for instance, if you take countries like other countries in Asia, some countries have moved into technology intensive production. They produce technology goods, technology based products.
Japan.
Yeah, Japan, South Korea, even countries like Thailand, Malaysia, they also. Now, actually, Sri Lanka, but these countries have been able to do it for one reason. And that reason is that they have invested in education and research and development. Two things: education,
yeah,
you know, improve quality of education, you have to invest in education. And then you have to invest in research and development, R&D. Now in Sri Lanka, we have not been able to actually invest enough in education. We have not been able to put in resources into technology development in the country. Now, Sri Lanka actually is one of the, Sri Lanka's investment in education is quite low in comparison to many other countries in the region and elsewhere. Now, we are still less than 2% of the GDP. Our educational expenditure, public expenditure in education is less than 2%. It's about 1.8%. Now, which is one of the lowest in the region. And then when you look at research and development, our investment is one of the lowest in the world, not just in Asia. You know, for instance, the most recent data shows that our R&D investment is 0.1%. 0.1%. Now, in comparison to neighboring countries like even India, India is now close to 1%. Ours is one-tenth of that. One-tenth of that. Now, of course, Sri Lanka being a small country, even 1% is not very much. But the fact of the matter is that even, you know, taking the very small budget that we are talking about, our investment in research and development is less than, it is 0.1%. Now, actually, in some African countries have even higher rates of investment in research and development. Now, you know, normally, there are certain global standards. For instance, if you want to have quality education, your target should be about 3% of the GDP. But many countries in Asia have gone beyond 3%. Now, if you take countries like you know, Korea, Malaysia, and so on and so forth, you know, they are very high in educational investment, you know, close upon, you know, 6%. But the UN UNESCO recommendation is that you should have at least 3%. Now Sri Lanka, you know, invests less than 2%. It's 1.8%, and it was even lower earlier. But anyway, more recently there has been some increase, and therefore, so the point is that you know, we have not been able to invest in research and development and education, and as a result, our quality of education remains low, and our technology capacity has remained almost negligible. Right now, you know, this situation is very 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 serious, because people who do well in education, you will always have a certain proportion of people who are very bright, who are very capable, and who really come up with a very high level of education, right? Now, these people don't remain in the country when you can't absorb them into the economy. So, in other words, we are losing the few people whom we produce every year to other countries. They end up in other countries. They end up in the United States, you know, in Europe, Australia, and so on and so forth. So, in other words, every year, the few people whom we produce out of our education system, few people with high skills, they are not going to stay in Sri Lanka. Which, in other words, we can never start a technology-driven development, industrial development in the country in the foreseeable future, unless we have a very deliberate plan, you know, program to revamp the economy, revamp the education system, revamp the technology sector in the country. Now, we have not been able to do that. So that is the economy. Now, I don't want to talk anything more about the economy. I think we can go on and on, but I think let me move on to the next area. That is reconciliation. You know, now Sri Lanka faced this crisis for 30 years. But on the other hand, this is really not something new, because we did not start well after independence. You know, after independence, we did not really take this particular issue seriously. And we did not adopt the right policies to reconcile the widening, divergences among our ethnic communities. I mean, we have three ethnic communities, and we have really not done enough to, ensure that these communities, remain together. These communities do not go in different directions. So, but unfortunately, what happened after independence was that that the gap between communities has been widening, and our state policies have not helped. In fact, our state policies have contributed to this widening gap. I'll give an example now. These divisions are very much connected to what we call identity politics. In other words, it's based on identities. You know, the Sinhalese think that they are Sinhalese and they are Buddhist, and the Tamils think that they are Tamil and Hindus, and the Muslims naturally think that they are Muslims, and so forth. I mean, that's natural for communities to have these identities. But you can either reduce that feeling, or you can reinforce that feeling. You can either reduce, you can reinforce. Now, how do you reduce? You reduce by allowing people to get closer, interact more with each other, have more common things to do, and so forth. And where do you start? You have to start with education. But unfortunately, in the case of Sri Lanka, we built our education system in a way that basically kept the communities apart. You know, because we have a de facto segregation in education. De facto segregation, not by law. It's by adopting certain policies. Now I'll give an example. Now if you take the school system in Sri Lanka, you have separate schools for Sinhalese and Buddhist.
Okay.
You have Hindu and Tamil schools for Tamils. Then you have Muslim schools for Muslims. I mean, there are exceptions, but this is the general pattern. Now, when children start very early in a segregated environment, they naturally don't have much to do with the other communities. So you see, they never get familiar with the other. They begin to treat the other as a stranger. In your own country, maybe even in your own village, because you don't have an opportunity. Because, you know, like a school is a place where you not only learn, it is also a place where you interact and form your own identity. Identity formation begins naturally at school. Now, if you perpetuate at public expense, if you maintain at public expense an education system that keeps, you know, children cut off from each other for a long period of time, starting from primary school up to the university, then naturally you reproduce these exclusive ethnic communities. So they naturally treat each other as strangers and sometimes, you know, as competitors. So now when you look at the conflict in Sri Lanka, we have, let's say, young people.
Yeah.
In Sri Lanka, young people have been living apart from each other, you know, for a long time. Say, for instance, we had the first youth party, youth organization, political organization, in 1970, around that time. The Sinhala youth party. And actually, if you take that, you know, the JVP, the Sinhala, and you know, they were basically an exclusive political, you know, community. And then, you know, then in the north and east, already in the 1970s, they started forming their own political organization, young people, right? And they started having, you know, let's say something comparable to the JVP in the north and east, like, for instance, the LTT and various other political groups. Now, you see, they were also exclusive groups. They had very little to do with the young people in the south. And, of course, you know, Muslims being a very small community, they did not have as vibrant, you know, kind of youth political parties as the Sinhalese and the Tamils, but nevertheless, you see, so now when you look at the 30-year war, I think it was very much connected to what I already told you. In other words, these young people, they were educated, they were given free education. They could go to university and so on and so forth. But they never thought that they had something in common. I mean, the JVP and the LTT, I mean, the people who belong to those two parties, they did not realize that they had something in common. But, you know, because they were operating independently of each other. But on the other hand, we know that in Sri Lanka, these exclusive political groups have played a very major part in that conflict, you know, because the anti-state campaign in the north and east was spearheaded by the LTT and other political groups and Tamil political groups. See, but they were mostly Tamil youth. Of course, the elderly people, the others, you know, certainly would have given their support and you know, encouragement and so on. But nevertheless, they were the people who were fighting. You know, like and that is because, you know, they considered themselves as an exclusive group, having a particular interest, political interest. You see, and that is why they sacrificed their lives and they fought against the Sri Lankan state, and so on. So anyway, so the point is that unless and until you bring these communities together, you know, in the political domain, you're not going to have sustainable peace in Sri Lanka. You're not going to have national unity in Sri Lanka. You're not going to have, you know, the citizenship that transcends these divisions in Sri Lanka. In a modern society, we talk about citizenship, and that citizenship has to transcend various divisions, and in particular, ethno-religious divisions. So if you don't transcend those divisions are going to surface and lead to various. So the second area that I already alluded to is national unity. And I think you have to have deliberate policies to address that issue. Now, there we know we certainly have to pay attention to education, attention to recruitment of people to government service, a medium of instruction in schools, you know, and then also the type of education that you impart to children, like for instance, some form of secular education has to be institutionalized within the school system, which we don't have, because there is a very very clear connection between religion and education in Sri Lanka. You see, so whereas in, as you know, in Europe, people became more and more secular because they were exposed to more secular educational institutions. But in the case of Sri Lanka, we never separated the two, and we continue to keep the two together even today. So in other words, you know, science and religion should be independent to a considerable extent. But in fact, we know in Sri Lanka, we have not been able to keep the two apart. And as a result, people do not know what is science, what is religion, what is myth, what is superstition, and so on and so. Okay, that is the second area.
Yeah.
The third is inequality. I think inequality is a major problem. And I think that is, again, something that has to be addressed through public policies. Now, I think it is, again, easier said than done. I think we have a neoliberal environment today in the country. And in the neoliberal environment, we tend to maintain very low taxation, And when you have very low levels of taxation, you know, you have two problems. One is the governments don't have enough resources to really invest in public you know, services, and then of course when you have very low levels of taxation, people who earn high incomes, they can just squander money, they can just waste money, they can just you know, engage in, you know, all kinds of private consumption, like, you know, buying the most expensive car in the world, sending children to the United States for education, buying a massive villa in Colombo, you know, go on holidays in other countries. You know, all this is really not possible for a poor country like Sri Lanka, but you know, this is happening. And when private consumption increases, you know, public consumption suffers. For instance, when you have more and more private cars on our streets, you can't have efficient public transport. Absolutely no chance. Because the roads are crowded. In crowded roads, you can't have a public transport system. Impossible. And the other thing is, when the government is not getting enough money, government cannot invest in public services. You know, you see, now we have not been able to build our railway system.
Yeah.
I mean, which is over 100 years old.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the British built the railway system in Sri Lanka. In fact, the British laid the foundation for a very comprehensive network of railways in the country. And the nationalists, you know, always say all kinds of things about the West, about, you know, English people and so on. But the fact of the matter is that the foundation of Sri Lanka's political system, Sri Lanka's government administrative system, Sri Lanka's education system, Sri Lanka's, you know, transport and other, you know, social infrastructure, all these things were laid during the colonial period. I mean, we have to accept the fact that it was the British, I mean, for whatever the reason, you can attribute to all kinds of reasons, but the fact of the matter is that they built the railway system. Now, what have we done after independence? We would have built that railway system and we would have improved on that. We haven't done a thing, you know, and as a result, we are struggling. And now it is impossible because the government has no money. Government not only has no money, government is indebted to the hilt. And as a result, we cannot mobilize public resources. When you can't mobilize public resources, you cannot invest in the transport system. You cannot invest in the health system. You cannot invest in the education system. You cannot invest in, you know, training and so on. You cannot invest in science and technology. You cannot invest in, you know, various other things that the people need, like social protection and so on and so forth. So the point is that we are in a very serious situation today in terms of social inequality. People with the money, they run riot. They can consume anything. They can buy any car, you know, in the world. And our roads are full of expensive cars today. Sri Lanka cannot afford even a small car. You know, I think if you really look at Sri Lanka's level of development, I don't think that we can have private transport in the country. But it's because of inequality that we have been able to have so many cars on the street. If you really impose decent taxation system, you know, in the country, you won't have, you know, all these luxury cars, you know, being used in the country. You will not have these luxury villas coming up everywhere in the country because, you know, point is that if people pay taxes, then they don't have such a huge, disposable income, and therefore they'll also have to use the public transport and so on. Now, say in Europe, as you can see, in many countries, people use public transport, you know, public transport. And that is because you have invested in public transport. And the public transport is reasonably efficient in these countries. And therefore, people tend to use public transport. But in a country like Sri Lanka, we haven't done that. And as a result, we have private consumption taking precedence over public consumption. So therefore, how to reduce inequality? How to reduce inequality? Because you cannot, unless you create equal opportunities, unless you maintain certain level of equality in the country, you're not going to have peace, because there'll be crime, there'll be a sense of injustice, and there will always be resentment, anger, deprivation, violence, and so on and so forth. So to really contain these various social issues, we have to have, a more equitable society. Of course, it's a matter of degree, but I think today we have huge disparities, and I think we have to contain those. So I think now these are the three critical areas that we have to address. And I think my plea to the government, to the president, was that we adopt sound, evidence-based national policies in various sectors so that we might be able to address these three pressing issues in the country. Issues connected with the economy, issues connected with reconciliation, ethnic relations, and then the issues connected with social solidarity. Because unless you create social solidarity, both intergenerational, between genders, and also between classes, you're not going to have social and political stability in the country. So without social and political stability, you're not going to be able to get on with the rest of the issues that you have to deal with.
Yeah, that's right.
I can ride my bike with no handlebars, no handlebars, no handlebars. I can ride my bike with no handlebars, no handlebars, no handlebars.
Look at me, hands in the air like it's good to be alive. And I'm a famous rapper even when the paths are all crooked-y. I can show you how to do-si-do, I can show you how to scratch a record. I can take apart the remote control, and I can almost put it back together. I can tie a knot in a cherry stem, I can tell you about Leif Erikson. I know all the words to De Colores, and I'm proud to be an American. Me and my friend saw a platypus, me and my friend made a comic book. And guess how long it took, I can do anything that I want, cause look. I can keep rhythm with no metronome. No metronome, no metronome. And I can see your face on the telephone, on the telephone, on the telephone. Look at me, just called to say that it's good to be alive in such a small world. I'm all curled up with a book to read. I can make money, open up a thrift store. I can make a living off a magazine. I can design an engine 64 miles to a gallon of gasoline. I can make new antibiotics. I can make computers survive aquatic conditions. I know how to run the business, and I can make you want to buy a product. Movers, shakers, and producers. Me and my friends understand the future. I see the strings that control the system. I can do anything with no resistance, because I can lead a nation with a microphone. With a microphone, with a microphone. And I can split the atom of a molecule, of a molecule, of a molecule. My reach is global, my tower secure. My cause is noble, my power is pure. I can hand out a million vaccinations, or let them all die in exasperation. Have them all healed from the lacerations, have them all killed by assassination. I can make anybody go to prison just because I don't like them. And I can do anything with no permission. I have it all under my command, because I can guide a missile by satellite, by satellite, by satellite. And I can hit a target through a telescope, through a telescope, through a telescope. And I can end the planet in a holocaust, 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 in a holocaust.
With no handlebars, no handlebars, no handlebars. I can ride my bike with no handlebars, no handlebars, no handlebars.
Und jetzt geht es weiter mit dem Gespräch mit Siri Hettich, Soziologe aus Sri Lanka, Colombo.
A book towards a sane society, because there you are saying it's about adolescents and youth, that it's normal to face also emotional and relational problems besides social and economic issues. And and if you see after 2004, after this tsunami, I mean, did that also affect somehow the whole development, because so much money was also like wasted? Is that also then related in how, because we were talking already also about the children and the youth in the country, but what I would like to know is the educational system already reacting on this or not? Also like making this kind of situation better like after this?
Well, actually, the education system is very important also from the point of view of you know, emotional and psychological health of people, particularly, you know, young people. But, you know, we have, as I already said that, we have not been able to really improve our education system. And today, education system is very much focused on just examinations. You know, I mean, the entire system is preoccupied with one issue, and that is examinations. But we all know that education system has so many other aspects, and we have to, you know, really improve on all those aspects. For instance, we don't have an effective counseling system in the schools. So as a result, you know, young children who face various problems are left alone, and they don't really get any kind of support from a counseling service. Like, for instance, now I'll give an example. Now we have over a million parents working in other countries. You know, in other words, they leave behind their children. You know, some of these children might be infants, some of them might be toddlers, some might be teenagers. Now, all these children who are left behind by their parents, either one parent or both parents, you know, come under enormous pressure, and they face various difficulties and so on. Now, you see, so therefore, you have to find an institutional solution. I mean, you know, like you can't stop people from going abroad for work. I mean, ideally they should work at home, but if they are not at home, then children face problems, and the children deserve some support. But unfortunately, we have not been able to provide any service, you know, to young children in schools. So as a result, they may get into various difficulties, like, you know, sometimes they get into, let's say, relationships very early, and these relationships can lead to all kinds of other difficulties, like even
mothers.
That's right, yeah, teenage pregnancies and so on. And then also, you know, like they may not do well in their education. They may not be able to really deal with each other, you know, in a friendly manner and so on. So there are all kinds of issues. So I think, so we need to actually address that issue. And the second is, you know, now after tsunami, I mean, over 100,000 families were affected, and they were displaced and they were resettled. I think initially, basic problems were addressed. Like, for instance, homes were built and they were given accommodation and so on. But the point is that that the impact of tsunami is not a short-term thing. Impact of tsunami lingers on. You know, it continues to impact on different segments of society on a long-term basis. Now, I'll give you an example. Now, in some families, you know, certain members were killed.
Yeah.
And they were, and as a result, the other members were traumatized, right? And that trauma is not going to be overcome within a month or two or even a year or two. In other words, it is something that has to be looked at over a period of time, long-term kind of management of trauma. And then another would be, let's say, elderly people who are taken, who are affected by the tsunami. And there are no long-term, you know, let's say, engagement with the elderly people who have been adversely affected by tsunami. And then infrastructure that were built. You have to maintain infrastructure. You know, for instance, now if you go around in the tsunami-affected areas, initially, social infrastructure facilities were provided. Like, for instance, you know, reading rooms, you know, community halls, health centers, you know, IT centers, you know, various things, and then children's parks, you know, all these facilities were provided, and roads and so on. But if you go to these areas today, you will see most of these things have disintegrated. Children's parks have been abandoned, no longer being used, you know, reading rooms and libraries, the IT center, they're all closed down. Then various other roads are, you know, eroded now, they're washed away, you know, and so and so forth. And then various other programs that were initiated to support livelihoods and so on, they are no longer operating. So the point that I'm trying to make here is that whatever you put in place after tsunami at an enormous cost, they have almost disintegrated in most of the places. Now this is exactly what I have observed over the last 2 years. I have gone to many areas in the north and east, as well as in the south, and I have seen this pattern. Now, this is really not conducive for a healthy living, decent existence for the people who were affected, displaced, and resettled. So the point is that all these things create social and psychological problems for the people. So we need to actually have, you know, targeted programs through various institutions, both public and private, in order to address these issues so that you can make the living conditions reasonable for the people. So I just gave you two examples now in the school system due to migration of parents, and then in the tsunami areas due to displacement and relocation. So, I mean, you can go on. I think if you go into the north and east, again, you have the impact of the war lingering on, creating problems on a continuing basis. So what is probably needed, therefore, is in addition to, you know, these, you know, macro interventions like schools, hospitals, and so on and so forth, you also need a more down-to-earth interventions, you know, targeting specific communities, particularly the vulnerable members of communities. It may be children, it may be teenagers, it may be elderly people, it may be the disabled, it may be any other group.
Okay. And did you also, because you were here for a conference also in Bielefeld, and you gave a paper on global student mobility as a potential driver of social, cultural, economic development. Was it an historical and contemporary perspective? Was that based on a study on the student mobility in Sri Lanka?
Well, I think our student population is bifurcated into two large constituencies. On the one hand, you have students who are not mobile, and they are basically, you know, young people belonging to lower class families. I mean, I would say lower middle and lower class families, and actually they are not mobile. They depend entirely on public educational institutions, both secondary schools as well as universities. So they are not very mobile. They are very much part of the local, but whereas over the years, a new constituency has emerged, new constituency of young people. And these are actually young people coming from more privileged kind of backgrounds, let's say urban middle class backgrounds and also upper class backgrounds and so on. Now these people do not depend entirely on public education system. They depend on new educational institutions that have been established over the last 20 to 30 years through private investment, like for instance the new international schools, new private colleges, and also those who go abroad for higher education with the support of their parents. Now actually these are the people who are mobile. They may be mobile between rural and urban, they are mobile between Sri Lanka and overseas. So it is these people who are exposed to new education, quote unquote new education. Let's say for instance these are the people who move into new areas of study like management, IT, languages, communication, engineering, and so on and so forth. Now these young people operate on a global level like any other in any other country. You see, they are mobile not only for education, they are also mobile for work. So you do not know where they would end up at the end of the day. It depends on the opportunities. So if you send your son or daughter to the United States for education, you can never be sure what will happen to that child, because that child might get a good education, might return to Sri Lanka, and might be accommodated in a corporate, let's say a private company, or maybe that person might start his own business venture, or might start his own training facility or whatever. You never know. Or else that particular person might find employment in the United States and will settle down in the United States, or migrate to Australia after the first degree. So you have a lot of global mobility happening as well. So you have two groups, two constituencies of young people, in fact, behaving very differently in the same situation, same country. You know, one group basically, not very much mobile, but the other group is very much sort of mobile. Now, what I feel is that students who are mobile or young people who are mobile have an enormous potential. Wherever they are, they are in a position to fit into the new economy that has come up. And I think if we can harness these people, I mean not everybody, but at least a substantial segment of this young population, if we can harness them, and really get them to work in Sri Lanka, it can really be a very major factor to bring about economic, social, and cultural change in the country, because they have been exposed to the world, they have new skills, and they are very agile, and they also have kind of a global orientation, and I think they can be quite useful for the country in order to bring about the necessary changes in the economy and also in the other areas that I just mentioned, like for instance they'll be able to build new institutions in the country or support new institutions, they can come up with new ideas and so on. So I think that is happening already in many parts of the world. Now, if you take East Asia, East Asian development has been facilitated by a number of factors, but one of the factors is what I call the reverse flow.
The reverse flow.
Reverse flow.
Yeah.
Reverse flow is the people who, young people who are going out, do not stay. I mean, many of them also have come back in the case of East Asia, whether it is Japan, South Korea, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Malaysia, Singapore. In all these countries, they have experienced a significant reverse flow over the last 30 to 40 years. Now, actually, these countries have benefited enormously from that reverse flow. You know, now, for instance, if you take South Korea is leading in technology-led, technology-oriented industrialization, you know. Now, how did that happen? It's because not only due to domestic policy of investing in education and science and technology, they also promoted people to migrate to other countries for education and training, and then they came back and they have become the catalyst in the process of change. Now, I think, so that's why I say that there is a potential, and I think Sri Lanka should also consider that possibility for Sri Lanka's so development, and that is that is the point that I made in my presentation at BLFL.
Yeah. Yes, Sri Lanka could be on the level like Switzerland, for example, from what it has, like the nature that should be safe and protected, and there a lot of jobs can come up in this area when they would start to develop their own products.
Well, I think Sri Lanka has an enormous potential.
Yeah.
Sri Lanka has an enormous potential, and I think Sri Lanka has not been able to tap that potential up to now. But I can see more and more young people are thinking on these lines, and they want to be innovative, they want to be creative,
yeah,
and they want to contribute. And I think it is up to the authorities, in particular the state, and maybe also the private sector, and also civil society organizations to really tap this enormous potential that Sri Lanka has to really have sustainable development in the country. So in fact, today we are talking about sustainable development. And in fact, Sri Lanka has taken some steps already. In fact, we have established a new ministry of sustainable development in Sri Lanka. Probably, this is probably something new also in the region. And I haven't heard that there is a new, there is a separate government ministry for sustainable development. But I think the whole idea is to really catalyze a process of change to promote sustainable development in the country. I think the world has no future without sustainable development. Because if we pursue the line of development that we have pursued over the last 30 years, we have no chance. I think we are going to get into more and more problems, and we will be overwhelmed by problems in the next 10 to 20 years if we don't really change the way that we address development issues in the country, in any country for that matter. So I think young people with new knowledge, with a global orientation, with new ideas, can really play a major part, and I think Sri Lanka has to mobilize these young people so that we might be able to address some of those issues that I already mentioned, and in addition to promote a more sustainable form of development in the country.
Ja,
das war das Gespräch mit Siri Hettich über im Grunde nachhaltige Entwicklung in Sri Lanka und die nächsten Schritte, die im Grunde jetzt zu gehen sind, nachdem es jetzt 2015, also letztes Jahr, einen Regierungswechsel gegeben hat. Denn Sri Lanka könnte tatsächlich von der Qualität, Lebensqualität, die man dort vorfindet, durch die Biodiversität tatsächlich auch ein Vorreiterland sein. Und das setzen wir auch noch fort. Man kann die Sendung auch noch unter Axiom auf der Seite fihe.org sich anhören. Und ja, auf bald. Jetzt kommen noch die absolut Beginners.
Splash! Könnt ihr noch? Habt ihr Bock? Habt ihr richtig Bock? Das ist schön. Wir auch. Lass uns das Ding jetzt zerstören hier.
Komm schon.
Ey yo, ich komm mit großem Herz und Pauken und Trompeten für die Obernanz und die saufenden Proleten. Die Messdiener, Crackdealer, Alt 68er. Alle sind happy, denn der Testsieger rappt wieder. Icy Ice. Jeder, den du kennst, kennt einer meiner Lines. Hammer-Typ, Hammer-Flow, Hammer-Sprüche. Darum hängt mein Bild in Masimotos Mamas Küche. Schreib Gedichte, schreib damit Geschichte. Jeder, der mich disste, ist bereits Geschichte. Alter, ich kam schon mit K2 und Hammer-Hart. Als ihr noch irgendwo im Sack von euer Vater war. Der Veteran von der Reeperbahn. Hab Hamburg hinter mir, als wär ich Uwe Seelermann. Und die Sonnenbrille, sie ist am Start, Baby. Sie ist der letzte Rest Privatsphäre. So, also was ist jetzt hier nicht los? Was ist jetzt hier nicht los?
Was los, Digga, Hahnmann? Wie wir gucken, wie wir labern. Jeder sagt, Digga, heutzutage wir backen aber wieder auf die Karte. Was los, Digga, Hahnmann? Wie wir gucken, wie wir labern. Jeder sagt, Digga, heutzutage wir packen aber wieder auf die Karte.
Dicken Kopf und kleinen Bau. Wortgewalt tätig, aber Masterpiece ich drauf. Triple A Pass, fremd im eigenen Land. Fette Anlageberater, Afro-Deutsche Bank. Dan, yo, ich komme rein. Halt ne Basspredigt und die Sonne scheint. Was Rap ist in der Sinnkrise. Guck, wie ich es hinbiege mit Arm wie Tim Wiese. Ist ein positiver Film, den ich schieb tief. Vom Mettendorfer Weg bis zur Green Street. Hier kommt die Band mit Geschmack, wenn jeder jetzt Peter einen auf Bandgegner macht. Und irgendwo zwischen Nitzehoe und Idaho kommt noch einer mit Jason Derulo featuring Tiger Flow. Ist leider so, vor uns ein Haufen Scherben, doch wir lassen uns die legendäre Stimmung nicht verderben.
Splash!
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 Seid ihr mit uns heute Abend?
Jesus, motherfucker!
Was los, Digga, Hahnmann? Wie wir gucken, wie wir labern. Jeder sagt, Digga, heutzutage wir packen Hamburg wieder auf die Karte. Was los, Digga, Hahnmann? Wie wir gucken, wie wir labern. Jeder sagt, Digga, heutzutage wir packen Hamburg wieder auf die Karte.